Hello, this is Gil Rothstein, and this is a response of a day for the 6th of Tevet. Today we're going to study the Sridi Eish's discussion of selling a shul. This is from Sridi Eish in the first Chelek, response number 18, and it's dated the 6th of Tevet of Tuf Reish Tzadi Bet of 1931. This was a question asked by the Rav of Oslo, so he's referred to as the Abbez Din Kodosh of Oslo, but I don't think there was a huge population of Jews even at that time. He says, the situation that's described in the Sridi Eish is there are two shuls in the city of Oslo. There's a big one where this rabbi is the rabbi, so he's sort of the chief rabbi of Oslo, but there's not that much in Oslo. And then there's a second shul, and he's got all the major donors in the community, the major people in the community. And then there's another shul, and the other shul used to have a rav, and it's about a year ago that rabbi left the shul for reasons that are unclear. He may have just found another position, he may have decided to move away. We don't know the answer to that, but they have not had another rabbi since then, and they don't have the financial wherewithal to get another rabbi, and they owe a lot of money. And by virtue of this other community still owing a lot of money, the problem is that they're worried that the non-Jews will foreclose on the shul, and they'll sell it in public, and that's an embarrassment to a shul in a community to have gone into such bankruptcy that they go into foreclosure. And therefore, what they want to do is sell that building. With the money they get from selling that building, they can pay off their debt so they don't have a foreclosure proceeding, and then they'll join with this existing larger shul, and they'll do it. So the process of selling a situation like this, if it's going to happen, is what's called doing it with Zayin Tuvei Ha'ir B'ma'am Anshei Ha'ir, meaning the assumption in the Gemara and in halachic literature was that a community has, we today might call it the executive committee of a shul, they have representatives of the community who can function in many situations on behalf of the community. Some situations where they can't function on behalf of the community, they can nonetheless do so if they assemble the entire community. So that's called Ayidei Zayin Tuvei Ha'ir B'ma'amat Anshei Ha'ir. If they get the members of the city together, the people of the city together, they don't have to actually literally take a vote among all the people in the city. They can just do what they want to do, or have the people who are there sort of give their assent by a claim. You know, sometimes you'll have a vote and you'll say, all in favor say aye, and you won't bother counting because it's so obvious that so many people have voted yes on that issue, so you'll just do it by a claim in that situation. So that would be this, you from the fact that the community just gathers and watches it, doesn't protest it, would be accepted, and then they could pay off, so they would sell the shul in that way, and then pay off the debt, the loan. And the truth is they want to join the shuls anyway, meaning they want to join the bigger shul anyway, because they can no longer sustain this smaller shul. So this is, we're going to see in the course of this tshuva, we'll see a discussion of the desire we have to let shuls flourish and have as many shuls as possible. But the flip side of that is sometimes there's not the financial resources to keep all the shuls going, and then it's not such a great idea. So here, even if they could theoretically scratch together the money to stave off foreclosure and sort of keep the shul limping along, they don't want to. And they also don't have a day school anymore. They don't have a Talmud Torah because they didn't have enough money. And if they join with... And if they join the shuls together, then they can have the benefits of all the institutions that the bigger shul has, and they'll be led by this rabbi. So I don't know if the question is self-serving, or if he just means that they'll have a rabbi. He's the rabbi in town, and they'll have a rabbi, and the rabbi will be able to guide them, and they'll come and listen to his speeches, and he may be able to push them and help them find their way to greater service of Hashem. So the question is, can they do so? And the reason why you might think they can't do so is there's halacha on the books. Now, today is going to raise other issues about just in general whether we can tear down shuls, whether we can stop davening in shuls and things like that, we'll get to. But the question that was most pressing for this rabbi from Oslo was the question of whether when you have a shul that's Beit Knesset Shel Krachim, the Gemara makes a distinction between small villages, let's say, which are called Beit Knesset Shel Kfarim. Their shuls are seen as private endeavors of the members of that village, of that community, of that town, of that area. But then you also have a situation called the Beit Knesset Shel Krachim. Beit Knesset Shel Krachim is understood to be actually the property of world Jewry, because a krach is a place where people come from outside the city as well, and they have lots of visitors, and the visitors expect that shul to be there as well, and therefore they are considered in some halachic way to have a share in it. And selling such a shul is a much more complicated endeavor, because it doesn't belong to the people in that city alone. It belongs to the entire world. So we'll come back to that at the end of this response as well. But that was the question this man in Oslo, this Rav in Oslo, had for the Sri Deish. So the Sri Deish starts the tshuva by saying there are two prohibitions in selling a shul. One is, as the Ran had said, well, there's two ways of saying the first one. Either you're lessening the kedusha of the building, and that's not okay. That would be the way the Ran said it. Or it's like a tashmishe mitzvah. So tashmishe mitzvah is an item we use to help us perform a mitzvah, which is the way the Ramban said it. And so that would be, have an item that has sanctity to it, and we are mistreating it by selling it, tearing it down, whatever we're going to do with it, but we're mistreating it. So you can't mistreat items of kedusha, items of sanctity. So that prohibition, Sri Deish says, that it's fairly clear that if you gather the Zayin Tuvei Ha'ir, the executive committee of the community, and they have the whole city with them, so then they have the power, lafgia ha'kedusha ayideh ha'mikriba. They have the power that when they sell it, they are, by selling it, removing the sanctity. And that's halacha in Orach Chaim in Kuf Nun Gimel, in 153. So that's not an insurmountable problem. The idea being that when we invest kedusha, when we invest sanctity in an item or a place, it's not always true that it becomes inherent to that place and irrevocably part of it. There are times when we can remove it, and this would be one of those times when you have, if you have the communal representatives of the community saying, we are no longer going to think of this as a kadosh item, it can be removed and therefore it can be sold. A second prohibition is bitul makom hatfilah, is that you have a place to be used for davening. It's not clear that we're allowed to stop a place that's being used for davening from continuing to be a place that's used for davening. So the Gemara in Rav Batra says that, let's suppose, and this is not a bitul tefillah issue, but let's suppose you have a shul, and you want to rebuild that same shul. This is halacha that comes up today, even in our time. You have a shul, and you want to rebuild that shul, you want to fix that shul, you want to renovate that shul. So the Gemara says, or you want to tear it down because you need a completely different kind of shul. The Gemara says you can't tear down a shul until you have another shul. So the Gemara seems to be saying, so that we're going to get into it, but the Gemara seems to be saying that you can't lower the number of available shuls in the world. So you can't remove a shul unless you have a shul to replace that's already in functioning to replace it. So now you'll do things like you'll rent a space for it, you'll have a space in which you can function as a shul, and that will be the fulfillment of the Gemara's requirement, there'd be another shul. But the Sri Deish says, included in tearing down is selling, because when you're selling it, it's also not a shul, because the point is that it's not being used as a shul anymore. So that you can't get rid of by the Zayin Tuvei Ha'ir, because it's not a function of what the community has decided or not decided. So the Gemara's telling us, we're not allowed to do this. The question is, what is it we're not allowed to do? So the Taz in Shulchan Aruch Kuf Nun Bet held that what the Gemara was worried about was that these people won't have a place to daven. So if there's already another place to daven in the community, you have communities where there are 15 shuls, and they're all within 3 blocks of each other. So in a community like that, the Taz would say, well, if the other shuls have room for these people, and they can absorb them, then that's not the issue the Gemara was concerned about. The Gemara was concerned about losing a place of davening and not having another one. But if you have another one, then you'd be okay. So in Oslo, where you clearly have another one, because the whole idea is they want to unite the shuls because they don't have the funds to support 2 shuls anymore, then it's clear that they have another shul, and therefore this whole problem doesn't become an issue, and the Taz would seem perfectly comfortable with them moving to the other shul in terms of this issue of bitul makom tefillah. Now that won't help with the problem that was raised in the question of whether, if you have a Beit Knesset Shel Krachim, if you have a shul that belongs to a big, large place, that really belongs to the whole world, so then you'd have that problem that you could say we can't sell it because you have people in the far reaches of the world who might disagree, and we'll get there. And the Magen Avraham will raise that issue, we'll get there. But in terms of this, he thinks it might be okay. Problem with following that Taz is the Magen Avraham explicitly disagreed there, and he held that no, they have to have built another shul for themselves, meaning that the Magen Avraham seems to hold, and that would be true even in a small Kfar, he seems to hold that unless you've built another one for that shul, so it's not a question of do they have a place to daven, it's a question of are we reducing the number of places of davening in the world. Magen Avraham seems to think we're not allowed to reduce the number of places of davening in the world. So the Magen Avraham disagrees, but there were other achronim who agreed with the Taz that you don't have to have actually built another shul, and that as long as you have another shul available, you're okay. So the Eliyahu Rabba follows the Taz, agrees with the Taz to be matir, as long as there's another set up shul. And the Ketav Sofer, the son of the Chatam Sofer, and then we'll go back to the Chatam Sofer later as well, he said that there are many, many matirim, many, many who allow it, and the only ones who disallow it, there aren't very many who disallow it explicitly, and therefore the Ketav Sofer says, as long as you have some other reason to also think it's mutar, then this can certainly include, this can be included, that we have another shul available, that can be included as a snif lahatir, it's called, right, as a support for being matir. Sridi Yesh says, in our Oslo case, he thinks there are many snifim matir. Sridi Yesh says, I got a bunch of ways to be matir. He says, there's a mabit who says that in the Beit Knesset shel krachim, that nobody ever davens in anymore, you can sell it. So that's going to be, now depending on what we're reading of that, we're going to find out, Chatam Sofer didn't read it that way. He thought that he only meant, he did not mean that. We'll get back to that in a second. But the Mabit seems to say that if nobody's praying there anymore, then the Gemara didn't talk about that. And that wasn't because, the idea would be that even if there are people far away in the far parts of the world, if they know that nobody's davening there anymore, it wouldn't matter to them if they sell it, because it's not being used as a shul anyway. So if that's true to the three of the age, that helps us out, because then what we can say is, let the smaller shul already fold into the bigger shul, meaning let them start davening in the big shul. Now, that will mean that nobody's davening in the small shul anymore. So he says, and there's no reason to think, now this is already, I think, an interesting question. He says, there's no reason to think that leaving the old shul is a problem, meaning people can daven where they want, he says. So that's interesting, because you have a Gemara that's saying you can't tear down a shul until you have another shul. Kids are down until you have another shul, because we don't want, and so there's a machlok with the Taz and the Magen Avraham. For the Taz, who just says it's because we want to make sure they have a place to daven, then the Sridi Yesh's idea makes sense. But if the Magen Avraham says that the idea is you can't reduce the numbers of shuls in the world, if that's what the Sridi Yesh really held, then if that's what the Magen Avraham really held, then it would make sense to say that it's not true, that if you have a small shul and everybody there is necessary to be able to fly the shul, then it's not clear to me why it'd be allowed. Meaning, what's the difference between if you have people davening the shul for the Magen Avraham, we say they can't close down the shul to rebuild a new shul, because there are temporarily only less than the shuls in the world, between saying, if I have only 10 people davening in a shul, and they say, we're tired of doing this, we're going to daven somewhere else, seems to me the Magen Avraham might have the same objection. But that's how the Sridi Yesh reads it. The Sridi Yesh assumes there's no problem leaving a shul, and if that means that the shul will end up not being davened anymore, that's fine, which is interesting to me, because when, you know, in my years on earth, I've had plenty of times when people say, oh, such and such shul is struggling, let's make sure to help keep it going. And the Sridi Yesh is saying, nah, if a shul is stopping to function, just because it's stopping to function, that's not our problem, what he seems to say. So he says, people can choose where they want, they do it where they want, and then he says that the Chasam Sofer all himself agreed, that's going to be important, because later on the Chasam Sofer will be the person who makes it a little bit of a problem to do this, that if you close a shul, that's not prohibited. Meaning close the shul by closing the doors, by locking them. Because the only problem is tearing it down. That's what the Gemara spoke about. And that's what we're worried about. And the fact that we're not going to have davening here anymore. We used to have davening. We had davening here 3 times a day until now. The Chasam Sofer didn't seem to think that was a problem. That's not a problem because they can daven somewhere else. So the Sridi Yesh doesn't say it explicitly, but it seems like even if we worry for the Magen Avraham, who says you can't tear down one shul unless you replace it with a shul, the Sridi Yesh is saying that there is room in the Achronim to say that that's only in terms of specifically tearing it down, but closing it up, that's okay. Then he says, it's also true that removing all the furniture from the shul is also not considered tearing it down, right? Tearing it down is when you tear down the building. The Magen Avraham quotes Maharam Padua, who says that netitsa, the definition of tearing down, is bimuchubar, is that which is tied to the ground, or in some way rooted in the ground. It's connected to the ground. So if you have benches and chairs and an Aron Kodesh and a Shulchan. So all of that you can move. The Chasam Sofer brings proof from David HaMelech, who brought the Aron Kodesh from Beit Shemesh to the Beit Oved Edom. And you have another one that... And you also have a Gemara in Makos, which seems to say that even if we hold that destroying that which is not tied to the ground is nonetheless considered destroying a shul. So let's say, I would say, destroying the wooden, but that's only for destroying, right? If it apply, even if it applies to that which is not connected to the ground, it's only if you destroy it. But if you're going to move from one place to the other, Chatam Sofer says that's okay as well. And there, because nitutz, destruction, is only when it's destroyed. All that put together, see, he says, well, you can close the shul, and that's not destroying it. And you can move the furniture, and that's not destroying it. And then once you do that, then nobody's going to be diving there anymore. And once nobody's diving there anymore, he's already said you can sell it, because we've said that we have a shita that says, that we have an opinion that says, if it's nobody's diving there anymore, then you can sell it, because then it's not a problem. So the shita says, but that doesn't really quite make sense, because after all, the Magen Avraham said, even in a kfar, even in a small town, you couldn't destroy a shul in order to build another one, because he was worried, even though you have another one, because we're worried about the fact that you'd be reducing the number of shuls. If you're reducing the number of shuls, so the Shri Desh is going to combine those things. He says you can allow, I'm sorry, I got ahead of myself. The Magen Avraham, he says, it doesn't make sense. The Magen Avraham said you can't tear down a shul in a small village because you're losing a place of davening. And then it should be you can't sell it either. And therefore, it should be true, if that's true, that you can't leave it either, because you're also closing down the thing of davening. So Sri Deish is sure that it's not true. He's sure that you can leave the shul, because why shouldn't you leave the shul? Right? So I think that the Magen Avraham might have said, no, if you have a shul in a kfar, you have to keep it going. But that's not the way the Sri Deish is. Sri Deish is very clear that, in his mind, the Sri Deish is very clear that this has to be okay. So therefore he says it's got to be that when you sell a shul, that gets rid of it forever. But if you just leave a shul, then it's theoretically possible people will come back. And while they're thinking about it, they have another place to davening, and therefore, and then if afterwards they decide to destroy it, well, that's the way it goes, and you should be okay with that. And that's not considered pshiyut, it's not considered negligence, and that's only, because negligence only applies to a currently functioning shul. But here, they just decided to stop davening. They're deciding to stop davening in the shul. He sure is okay. They close the doors, and that's still okay, he thinks. And they daven in another place. And then if they decide no longer to daven in this place ever again, that's okay. Now, the Shri Deish is claiming that even according to the Magen Avraham, this is what he's saying, even according to the Magen Avraham, who holds you can't remove a place from davening, he means a currently existing davening place, and he means while there's still people davening there. So if they want to renovate, and they're thinking about tearing it down and rebuilding another one, that they can't do unless they set up a place in the meantime, because you're not allowed to stop existing places. But says the Sri Deish, there's no way he understands it to be. There's no way the Magen Avraham meant that as soon as you have a place of davening, you have to do everything you can to keep it going. If it doesn't keep going, it doesn't keep going. But you can't tear it down while it's still going. So what you can do is, so that's one way around it then. Stop davening there. And he thinks that includes locking the place, and nobody could daven there. Meaning, not only are you stopping davening there, you're stopping people from being able to keep it going because you're locking the place, you're moving out all the furniture. That he thinks is all fine, because none of that qualifies halachically as destroying it. So there's a lot, it feels to me like there's a lot of legal fiction going on here, because if we move the furniture out of a shul, it may not qualify halachically as netitza, as destruction, but it's certainly not going to make it possible to keep the shul going. And his whole idea was that the reason why this isn't a problem for the Magen Avraham, who held you're not allowed to reduce the number of places of davening in the world, was that you're not quite destroying it just by stopping to daven there. But if you're, in addition to stopping to daven and to daven there, you are also you're also locking it and taking the furniture out. So it's an odd to me. It's an odd claim to make. More than that, he has another problem. The Panim Me'irot had written in the name of Rabbi Halevi that you're also not allowed to stop people from davening in a certain place, or to build a new shul. That ha'me'akev livnot b'chlal netitza v'harisa. that if people want to build a shul and you stop them, that's almost like destroying a shul. And that's included in that, in destroying the shul. And according to that, then it would be all the more so prohibited to leave a shul. So the conclusion there, though, he says, if you look in that, in the Stei Chemed, who quotes all of this, the Stei Chemed is an anthology that collects a huge amount of materials, like almost like an encyclopedia from, I think, the late 19th, early 20th century. So the Stei Chemed there, he says that maybe that was only said when they don't have another one. If they have another one, then it's okay, and then there might be room to say, so he quotes a second opinion, a second idea along the same way, Shari Tshuva, in the name of the Rivash, who also said that if you stop people from establishing a new place to daven, then you should begin nidui, meaning there's a form of excommunication for that, because it's wrong to do. But then he writes, that's true even if they have a shul, unless the community makes a specific ruling on the issue because of the needs of the community. Meaning, the Rivash is pointing out already back then, there are times when it's not a good idea to build an Israel. Meaning, if you have a huge shul and it's functioning fine, it's got plenty of people in it, and there's no problem with it, and there are people who want to build a new shul, we're not supposed to be opposed to that, because letting shuls flower is a good thing. Now, that gets into all sorts of questions, because it's unclear that there's a man in my neighborhood who repeatedly tells me he thinks the more shuls, the better, and that's what causes communities to grow. Maybe, but I think there are also plenty of times when shuls have a hard time supporting all, communities have a hard time supporting all the shuls that they have. And not only is it that they have a hard time supporting all the communities they have, I think it's also worth paying attention to the fact that the money that goes to shuls might be money that comes away from something else, meaning the shuls are sort of an easy sell maybe in terms of fundraising, but it means that the funds that go to that can't go to something else. So I think all these are hard questions. The Rivash is already pointing that out, that you're not allowed to stop people from creating new places of davening, and trying to stop it is something that was worth the need to do with communication, unless the community comes to a realization that there's a problem, and then that would be an issue. But in our situation, there's no reason to be machmer on this issue, because it's clear that uniting the shul is going to be better for the community, because first of all, you have a bigger minyan, and we do have a general principle in halacha of birov am hadrat melech. The more people daven together, all other things being equal, the better it is. Not only that, by coming to this shul, they'll have a real rabbi. The Sri the Eish clearly respects this man and thinks of him as a good quality functioning rabbi. And not only that, but they'll also get more used to davening every day, meaning it seems like in this dying shul, they no longer had daily minyan. So if they no longer have daily minyan, then they get out of the habit of going to shul daily. They don't realize that minyan is something supposed to be done every day. But now if they combine the shuls and they have a rav who's going to try to help them realize that it's important to come to shul regularly, so then it'll be good for everybody. And therefore, he says, he thinks that there's a good reason to unite the shuls, and it's a mitzvah, and therefore he's finding all these ways to help them out with all these ideas that he had. Stei Chemed had also quoted a Shut Mishpia Shmuel, who had said that any time that it seems clear that it's going to be impossible to go back and daven in a certain shul, then you assume, even if it's a shul that belongs to the whole world, because it's in a big city, you assume that everybody would agree. So you have all these reasons now to say that we can sell this place as well. Nobody's davening here anymore, or not enough people. So if you close it up, you move the furniture out, then everybody seems to agree that you can sell it for all these reasons. The problem for the 3DH is that the Chatam Sofer doesn't hold that way. We're not going to get into this Chatam Sofer here in the name of time, but the Chatam Sofer reads the Mabit in a way that says, no, you can't sell a Beit Knesset Shel Krachim, a shul in a big city which belongs to people all over the world, even if nobody's davening there anymore, and therefore the Chatam Sofer held you couldn't do it. So the 3DH says, even though most poskim, most authorities don't agree with him, and even the Magen Avraham, who held you couldn't sell things, sell the wood and the stones, didn't mention this whole idea, but nonetheless, he's the Chatam Sofer. So that's a reminder of who the Chatam Sofer was, how large he loomed in the eyes of people who came after him. I mean, the Sri Deish is writing more than a century later, 100 years later, and the Chatam Sofer's name is so powerful that it's hard to imagine for him, or it's hard for him to just say, yeah, we'll go against the Chatam Sofer. And therefore, he says, a way to get around it is, if you take at least some of the money that you get from selling the shul, and you give it for either rewriting a Sefer Torah, meaning taking an existing Sefer Torah and paying for a sofer, for a scribe, to check over it to make sure that it's well written, properly written, or to help an orphaned girl, young woman, get married who would not otherwise have the money to get married. And the reason why he mentions those causes is those are two causes that in halacha are explicit reasons that won't be allowed to sell a shul on its own, meaning ordinarily we don't sell a shul, but those are causes that are so important that halacha allows selling a shul. So if you have a shul that you're going to sell for all the reasons already said, and get money from it. And all the reasons he said, except the other's one Chatam Sofer that he's worried about, so he says this will help with that as well. Because if we give some of the money to this causes, that would be a cause that would justify selling a shul already. All of that was to struggle with the question of how you sell a city, a shul in a krach, in a big city, for the reason we said that the Gemara says that a shul in a krach, in a big city, it doesn't actually belong only to the members of that krach of that city. It actually belongs to the whole world, because you have people who come from outside the city, and they plan to daven there, and they expect to be able to daven there, and therefore, and they it sort of becomes part of them as well, and that's what complicates selling it. But then he says, through the age now, says he's not sure that for these purposes, Oslo qualifies as a big city. Because even though the Mishnah Berurah says that a big city is a place where there's a lot of people, it's true, who come and who go back and forth. But unless they're kviye shama, then it's called a kvar. It has to be, the Mishnah Berurah said, not just they happen to pass through, but the people come for significant periods of time, meaning you have people who come to do business and they'll stay for 3 months, and then they'll leave. They'll stay for 2 months, and then they'll leave. Right? So then, in such situations, you assume that the people who are planning coming to stay for a while will rent a place or buy a place or expect to have a shul available to them. And they won't have it, and that's the whole situation. But he says he's never heard of Oslo. That's a place, yikbu'u hasochrim, that you have merchants who come and they stay there for like a half a year. And therefore, he says, he thinks that the halach of krachim doesn't apply. Because the halach of krachim isn't people will happen. There's so many people that they'll happen to pass through. The halach of krachim is that the people will come and settle there, or temporarily, expecting to have full Jewish institutions there. The truth is, that wouldn't be a problem for Oslo anyway, because again, they're providing them another opportunity, but he doesn't get into that. He just says he's not sure that it qualifies for this reason as a Beit Knesset Shel Krachim. He quotes also Shut Pnei Yoshua, who says also that it's a question of, they come to think of that shul as theirs in some way. So if they pass through 2-3 days a year, that's not thinking of it as theirs. They come so frequently and for extended periods that it's theirs as well. And then, and that's the reason, meaning it's not some theoretical thing that belongs to the world. It's a theoretical thing that there are people who we don't realize use this shul relatively regularly enough that they qualify as members, and we won't have them around when we're having the Zayin Tuvei Ha'ir B'Ma'amat Ancheir with all the members of the community there. So if you kept through a good, you know, so that suggests that even if you had a shul like that, but you had an excellent membership list, or not just membership, like paid membership, but you had a list of all the people who ever were there, you know, for more than 2 months a year, then maybe you could consult with all of them before you sold it, and maybe then you could also sell it. But he doesn't raise that issue. He just says, in Oslo, none of that is true. You don't have, Oslo, not a community, it's not a city where Jewish people tend to come and settle for extended but not permanent periods of time. And therefore, before the therefore, the Sith, Sri the H points out also Gemara in Megillah, talks about a certain Shul Yerushalayim that belonged to Tursiim, and since they only built it for a specific segment of the community, a small segment of the community, you know, let's say we would build it for computer programmers, you know, in the city. So once you do that, even though it's in a big city, you don't treat it as a big city, you treat it as a kfar for those purposes. And therefore, he suggests, now we're up to the therefore, therefore, he suggests to the rabbi in Oslo that he check when they built the shul, that shul that's now dying, and they want to close it up so they can save communal resources. When they built that shul, did they build it for the world, or did they build it for the members of the city of Oslo? The odds are, the likelihood is, that it was for the latter. They had no idea of building it for the world. So then he adds in, so that would help us. If that were true, then we could maybe treat it as like a kfar and not like a krach, like a small townish shul, not a big city shul. He also says, nowadays, the Pnei Yoshua had pointed out that in their times, this has been a lot lost in recent times, but in their times, they used to literally sell seats in shul. And literally sell seats in shul, people paid money not just to be members of the shul, they paid money for a particular seat. We've seen other shivot together about the relative value of certain seats in certain locations, and it was considered a Yerusha, it was considered an inheritance that you pass on to your children, and had a real monetary value. But Yeshua says, once that's true, and that means that if I walked into shul, and people get upset about this, but they're not paying attention to the financial element of it, but if I walked into shul and somebody's in my seat, it would be like somebody's in my apartment, somebody's in my house, and I would say, excuse me, that's my seat. So people today get very upset about that idea. But I think it it loses sight of the where it came from. It came from the fact that it was really mine, not in the sense of I tend to always sit here, but it was mine in the sense of I bought it and it's mine and you're using it. You know, imagine if there was a big parking lot of cars, right? And there was a general idea that people come using the cars, but I had bought a parking spot and I put my car in a certain spot. So people might not know it, but if somebody was sitting in my car, you know, let's say it was a drive-in movie theater, and the theater put cars in all the spots that belong that didn't have anybody in them, because they wanted people to be able to also just walk up and be able to see the movie for a fee, whatever it was. They wanted to just be open to that. So I walk in, somebody's sitting in my car, I would say, I'm sorry, that's my car. There's plenty of cars there. So that's the kind of thing that's going on here. Once that's true, says the Pnei Yehoshua, so then it would no longer have the halach of a Beit Din Shul, of a Beit HaKnesset Shul Krach, of a big city shul, because it's sold out to specific people. Once it's sold out to specific people, then you don't have to any longer think of it as belonging to the entire world. Then he adds one more thing. And a lot of times in shuls, what happens is one person was really the driving force behind the building of the shul. He collected the money, and he got the contractors, and he oversaw everything. And in that situation, he says, you can sell it as well. This is the H says, you can sell it as well, because it's really, for all that it's in a big city, it's really the shul that belongs to this guy, right? Because he's the whole reason that the shul got built. And whatever he had in mind, that's what he had in mind. So if he had in mind that he could sell it eventually, that the community could sell it, then you should be able to sell it as well. And the Sudei says, and that's true even if it's two people or a couple of people, and therefore, if you just check into it, he says, and you find out that that's the way this shul was built, then that would help us also with adding snifim lahater, with adding reasons that we can be matir selling this shul. So that's where the Sudei H really comes out. But then at the very, very end, the last little piece of it, he says, but I recently saw that the Minchas Elazar, which was the Munkacha Rav, and people apparently respected him greatly, he held that, no, you should be machmer like Chatam Sofer, and you shouldn't be able to sell a shul like this. And so therefore, he says, it would be better if you could find a way not to sell it, but to find a Jew who's willing to pay off the debts of this shul and will buy the location, and you can set it up as a Talmud Torah, as a school, and you could maybe have a small minyan there, but you could set it up as some kind of a charitable institution. And that's not really selling the shul, it's converting it into another communal purpose, and then you avoid, so you can get the money for it by selling it to that institution, but that institution doesn't qualify really as violating the issur against selling a shul, and you can pay off the debts, and you can work it out that way. So if you could do that, that would be better, because that would keep in mind what bothered the Chatam Sofer, and now the Munkacha Rav, the Minchas Elazar. And if you can't do that, he says, get back to me, and I'll talk to the Minchas Elazar, maybe he'll agree with me that there are reasons that we can be matir selling it in this situation. So fundamentally, Sredesh thinks it should be okay for all the reasons that we've reviewed, in terms of whether it's really a Beit Knesset Shel Krach, whether it really qualifies as a shul that belongs to a big city. Even if it did belong, qualify as a shul that belonged to a big city, there are reasons to sell it, in terms of you close it up, you take out the furniture, then nobody's davening anymore, there's reasons to say that you can sell it then. But with all that, there are important rabbis who say you can't sell it even then. If that's true, then you have this problem that could be unworkable, and that's why the Sridi Eish recommended converting it into a different kind of institution. And if it couldn't be converted, he would talk to the Minchas Elazar and see if they could agree that you could sell it. And that is a response of a day for the 6th of Tevet from Tafrej Sadi Bet from 1931, Sridi Eish, on selling a shul. Have a great day.